Welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life, produced by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. We all want to do everything we can to help our kids be healthy, happy, and to thrive. But how can we as parents know everything that our child needs in terms of health and building a strong immunity, and in terms of their behavioral and mental well-being? Well, the truth is, we can't. So that's why we build a team of experts to help us. So, how is that team doing? When it comes to our children's health, despite help from medical doctors, most data shows that kids are sicker today than ever. It shows they have more physical, emotional, and behavioral issues than ever before. According to today's guest, information shared almost 20 years ago, which should have been a wake-up call then, is now a siren-blaring SOS call that can no longer be ignored.
This article came out in 2005. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this article predicted that we were now at the point that for the first time in history, our children are very likely to have a shorter lifespan than us, their parents, and all due to diet and lifestyle-related factors. And guess what? Diet and lifestyle-related factors, they are the things that we have in our control.
What can we do to raise healthier and happier kids? We have the answer to that question. So listen in and learn. The good news is, it's not too late. The purpose of this podcast is to foster discussion, not to provide advice. The information shared should never be used as an alternative to obtaining personalized advice from a healthcare professional. And listeners should seek such advice independently if they have any questions related to their physical or mental health. This podcast hosts different viewpoints, and the opinions of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the views of HPE. Hello, and once again, welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life. I'm Bob Peacock. In one of our recent episodes, a featured guest was a medical doctor who said that most physicians today tend to make a living fixing things once they're broken. They treat physical and mental issues when we have problems, and they prescribe drugs that make us feel better when we're sick. But they do very little to help make us and keep us healthier in the first place. With no disrespect at all intended toward the medical profession, our guest's point was that rather than celebrating doctors who are treating us when we're sick, the real heroes are those who are focused on making us and keeping us healthy in the first place. Today, I'm happy to say that we'll be hearing from one of those heroes. Dr. Elisa Song started out her career more than 20 years ago as a medical doctor. But after going through pediatric medical training at Stanford University, New York University, and the University of California, San Francisco, she noticed that traditional medicine was missing some important pieces of the puzzle when it comes to helping kids be as healthy as possible. In fact, by treating kids with antibiotics and antacids, as she was trained in medical school, we might actually be doing more harm than good. So today, Dr. Song is an integrative pediatric physician, and she has dedicated her life to helping parents and practitioners learn that with an integrative pediatric approach, persistent health concerns that are affecting most of our children today can become a thing of the past. And she's shared her insights through a must-have book titled Healthy Kids, Happy Kids. Dr. Elisa Song, welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. What an honor to be speaking with everyone around the world.
So after opening up your practice, you quickly learned that traditional medical care was not enough to keep our kids healthy. So let's start there. You'd think that after all these years of building on data and experience, medical care would be making our kids healthier today than ever before, but that's simply not the case. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because, of course, I think pediatrics is a special specialty in that we're caring from kids from the moment that they're born, and there's so much hope and joy as babies are coming out into the world. And yet what we find, and it's so true, as you said in your introduction, we really don't have a lot of tools in our conventional pediatric toolkit to truly move the needle forward for kids to help them thrive for the rest of their lives. And our healthcare system is not designed to pay for prevention, unfortunately. Preventing a disease where we are really enabling kids and adults to no longer need prescription medications or no longer need costly medical visits and specialty care is really not in the interest of the healthcare system. And I'm not saying that there's any malintent there. This is just the way the system was really formed. And so there's really not a great incentive from a medical, conventional medical perspective to say, hey, how can I make it so that you eventually will put me out of my job? That would be a dream come true.
Wouldn't it?
I mean, could you imagine a world where kids were really thriving so much that maybe they needed the occasional, the truly well check? And, you know, here's the thing. When I see a kiddo for an annual well child visit, very, very rarely is it truly a well child visit. There's typically some concerns about my child is getting sick so frequently, you know, ear infection after ear infection, or they have eczema, or they have behavioral concerns. They can't sit still in class and they're constantly getting into trouble, or they are weepy and isolated and I don't know how to get them out of it. So these are not kids who are truly, truly well. And so if we are going to have that opportunity to create truly well kids, we need more than just a 15-minute well child visit.
And I want to spend most of our time today sharing some of the practical tips and ideas that are in your book on how we can raise healthier and happier kids. But I think before we do that, it's important to spend just a few minutes talking about the difference between the approach of a medical doctor, what you learned in medical school, and the approach of an integrative doctor. And I'd also like to understand why there's a difference in the approach.
So when we talk about integrative medicine, it's really integrating conventional medicine. And I do believe it's really very important to be firmly grounded in a conventional medical approach to understand, well, what are the scenarios that might be more serious that require a referral to specialty or to the hospital or to the ER? But then we have all of these other modalities that we can bring in that can help buoy that child up and that family up with nutrition, diet and lifestyle, mindfulness as medicine. There are all sorts of other modalities, including homeopathy and herbal medicine and acupressure and essential oils, each of which I incorporate into my practice from an integrative standpoint. So we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We're not saying, oh, never, ever give antibiotics or fever reducers or antacid medications. What we are saying is learn when they're absolutely necessary and also understand some of those unintended consequences of these necessary medications to your child's developing gut microbiome or to their immune system or to their brain so that we can mop up some of those unintended consequences and help your kids move forward from whatever's going on to really help them be as healthy and happy as possible.
Let's go back to when you first started your practice. There was something published in the New England Journal of Medicine that I think was probably one of those red flags that told you that things need to change.
Yeah, that was in 2005. I had started my practice in 2004 as an integrative functional medicine pediatric practice. I was fairly fresh out of residency. I had finished my residency at UCSF in 2000. And to be honest, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Even after, you know, 4 years of medical school and 3 years of pediatric residency, because I didn't see any model of care, whether it was being a hospitalist or a specialist or having a private practice that really called to me, that really was practicing preventive pediatrics until I found functional medicine and an integrative approach. And so when I opened up my practice in 2004, I thought, wow, this is what an amazing opportunity for me to really and truly make the difference that I started out in pediatrics wanting to make. And this article came out in 2005, just after I had opened up the practice. And it was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this article predicted that despite our lifespans having increased for centuries due to the advances of modern medicine, we were now at the point that for the first time in history, our children are very likely to have a shorter lifespan than us, their parents.
That is mind-blowing.
Mind-blowing. And all due to diet and lifestyle-related factors. And guess what? Diet and lifestyle-related factors, they are the things that we have in our control. And so, yes, there is sort of this air of doom and gloom in those statistics. And yet, there's also this air of empowerment because we do have a lot of control over what we eat and how we live and how we sleep and how we use our minds. And so there's a powerful message in that. And the message is only as powerful, though, as what we do with it. And so this is now nearly 20 years later. It's time. It's time for us to get this information out and really know that we as parents and educators and practitioners, we have the tools to make a difference.
And you can understand why parents are maybe skeptical about homeopathic treatments. When our kids' temperature starts to soar, it scares us to death. We get really concerned. Mm-hmm. But where a traditional doctor might prescribe a drug, you'd say that fever actually helps our children's immune systems fight infection, and it can even help our child get over their illness even faster. You know, when I was a kid, my doctor would prescribe an antibiotic when I got sick, not even checking to see if he was dealing with a bacterial infection. But if we didn't improve, the doctor would just prescribe something even stronger. What's the problem with that?
Yeah. So, and you know, here's the thing. I tell parents, it's not that there's never a time for these. And that's exactly why I wrote the book, because I wanted to bring the education and the science and the research to parents so that they can feel confident understanding when these medications may be really necessary, when maybe there's some wiggle room. And again, let's not take those antibiotics or let's not try the fever reducer, but what else can we do from an evidence-based standpoint to get your kids better faster? And when we have that knowledge of some of the unintended consequences of antibiotics, it does help parents to take pause and have that dialogue with their doctor. And, you know, I grew up just like you. My mom actually was an OBGYN, and I remember every sore throat, every sniffle, you know, here you go. Here's that pink bubblegum medicine.
Right.
And so now we understand it is not as benign as we think. Well, let's take it from a global public health perspective first. The World Health Organization now is calling for antibiotic stewardship, that we really need to be very judicious in how we prescribe antibiotics and how we use antibiotics. Because by 2050, which is really right around the corner, there are concerns that antibiotic resistance will become a leading cause of death worldwide. That is from, you know, the early 1900s, where antibiotics were truly one of the most important public health inventions of our time, to now coming to a point where simple infections, we will no longer have the antibiotic tools to use because we are overusing and inappropriately using antibiotics. And in some studies for children, they found that nearly 70% of antibiotic prescriptions for children are inappropriately prescribed. So that's one concern. Now, when I have a child in front of me, I'm thinking, yes, there's public health concerns, but I'm really focused on this individual child right in front of me and what that means for their health. And antibiotics, while they can kill the bad bacteria, they're not judicious in what they kill. They can kill all of the beneficial bacteria right along with the good. And I would venture to say that worldwide, nearly everyone has heard of probiotics. You can't help but go to a store and see, you know, probiotics on the shelves or in the refrigerator section, and have heard or read about the gut microbiome. When we think about our gut microbiome for our children, it is especially important to understand that the way that their microbiomes develop from infancy, from the moment they're born through their childhood and adolescent years, really informs how their microbiome educates and forms their immune system with their gut immune system connection, and also educates how their brain will develop and how their mental health will develop with the gut brain connection. When we think about antibiotics in infancy, and this is where I take a little pause and let moms and dads know, if this was your child, it's never too late to optimize and restore your child's gut microbiome, no matter what's happened in the past. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this work if there was no hope. But we do know that antibiotics or antacid medications, which also disrupt the gut microbiome, given in the first 6 months of life, can significantly increase the risk of your child developing by 4 years of age virtually every single allergic disorder, like eczema or asthma or hay fever or anaphylactic food allergies. With 1 in 5 children diagnosed with eczema nowadays and anaphylactic food allergies on the rise, you bet we want to look at that baby's gut microbiome to see how can we prevent this, or how can we prevent this from progressing to an even worse state. And we also know that antibiotics given to infants, especially in those first 6 months of life, but any round of antibiotics, can significantly increase the risk of that child developing a mental health concern by the time they're older kids or teenagers, by up to 50% in some cases. Now, I know some parents right now are going to be clicking their memory back and thinking, oh my gosh, but that was my kid. My kid had antibiotics when they were 3 months of age, and now they're a 12-year-old dealing with anxiety and, you know, dealing with really, harmful thoughts. And so this is where the knowledge begins. Knowledge truly is power, because then when we realize, you know, that skin condition or that immune system imbalance or the mental health concern, it's not just a skin or immune or brain concern. It is a gut microbiome concern. And then we know where to look and we know how to move forward.
So how does a parent know when his or her child needs antibiotics? When are antibiotics necessary, and when should you take a pass?
Yeah. So there are a few cases where I do say antibiotics are truly necessary, you know, from the beginning. Strep throat, you know, that's a bacteria that can cause a pharyngitis, throat infection. I do treat with antibiotics. Whooping cough, I treat with antibiotics. Urinary tract infections in young children, I will treat with antibiotics. And so the key is, though, knowing that it is a bacterial infection. So for instance, let's take a strep throat. There is no way that any doctor, no matter how seasoned they are, can look at your child's throat, even if it's really bright, beefy red, and swollen tonsils and white spots everywhere. That can be strep, but it can also be any number of viral causes for pharyngitis, including the monovirus, Epstein-Barr virus. And so you have to know, you have to do a swab for a culture to know for sure that it's bacterial, unless, of course, the whole family has strep, or all of your kids' friends have strep, and then you can get that from the history. So how do you know, though? There's a lot of rigor for most cases, and most illnesses that children will get are going to be viral. We know viral colds, you know, upper respiratory infections, viral gastroenteritis, or stomach flus. When you are at the doctor's office and you're getting checked out because you're concerned, does my child need antibiotics or not? There's one really important question to ask, and that is simply that question that I just asked. Hey, doc, is this antibiotic really necessary? Just by asking that one question, you're doing many things. You're first letting the doctor know that you're not one of the parents who's coming in simply with the goal of walking out the door with an antibiotic prescription, that you really do, you want to do the best by your child and you want to use antibiotics, but only if they're absolutely necessary. And then you're also opening the door to really discussing what are some other potential options. What else can you do in the meantime? Well, you're waiting to see if antibiotics may be necessary.
Absolutely. Let's talk about our kids' mental and emotional health. A University of Michigan survey from 2016 said that today's kids have more stress and less quality family time than in the past. And it said that 55% of those surveyed thought kids today have worse mental and emotional health than when they were kids. And that's pretty consistent with other statistics related to bullying and stress and suicide and depression. In terms of a child's mental health, what are you personally seeing as a practitioner, and what should parents be doing to better support the mental and emotional health of their kids?
Yeah, there's, you know, when we think about kids' mental health, and so that study was published in 2016, so that was, or 2015, that was before the pandemic, and things really, we know, have just gotten worse.
Absolutely.
You know, even before the pandemic, we know that our kids and teenagers were in a mental health crisis. And throughout the pandemic, there really was this emergency call that we are in a state of mental health emergency for our kids and teenagers. And some of the latest numbers for our teenage girls in particular found that since the pandemic, around one in three girls, teenage girls, has seriously contemplated suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
One in four teenage girls actually has come up with a plan. And then there's one in two who has actually tried. And so This does not just start all of a sudden they become a teenager and their mental health slides. We know that the groundwork gets set long before they're teenagers. And we know, I mean, there are emergency room visits from eight-year-olds with suicidal ideation and attempts, even as young as five. And so when we think as parents, how do we protect our kids from what's going on? There's so many different facets that we can consider. One of the things that I really want parents to understand is part of what's happened to us as adults and also to our children is that we have lost a lot of our stress resilience. And what I mean by that is we've lost a lot of our ability to manage life's little stressors and to overcome them successfully so that we can even more successfully manage the next stressor and the next stressor or the even bigger stressor. Because stress in our society has really become the next four-letter word.
Right.
When people say, I'm so stressed, or who when asked if they're stressed says, no, very few people. Mm-hmm. So stress has become a negative word. And what I want to flip that script and really help parents and kids understand, stress is not actually a bad thing in and of itself. Stress is actually a very normal physiologic response to getting ready for something, to preparing for something that might be a little bit of a danger alarm in you. And then your body assesses and your brain assesses, do I need to be on high alert or can I calm down and relax? And this push and pull of this alarm state and then relaxation state is constantly going on. And it's an evolutionary response. I mean, everyone's heard of the proverbial saber-toothed tiger. Mm-hmm. You bet our body needed to kick into the stress response to be ready to either fight or run or freeze,
right?
But then once the saber-toothed tiger is gone and we're in safety, those safety signals need to kick in and we need to get back into that calm, rest, digest, restore state. What's happening nowadays is instead of being 80% in that rest and recover state, we're 80% in that fight or flight state. And we've flipped. We're constantly in this stress mode. And now we are viewing all stress as negative, as, oh my gosh, I need to avoid the next stress. I can't have anything that's stressing my child out. And we're not learning how to manage that stress to be able to really upload our safety signals. So that's one thing. As parents, we just want to understand if your child is anxious about something or stressed about something, even from toddlerhood, I remember, you know, my child getting so frustrated about, you know, not being able to tie his shoes the right way. I mean, it was such a clear memory. And what do we want to do as parents? We want to fix it for them. We want to make it right. Or my daughter, when she forgot her recorder in middle school. So my first instinct is, okay, I'll be late to work so I can run home and get the recorder and bring it back in. But that's not helping them learn how to manage that situation. Of course, you support them with it and you give them the tools to manage. But when we learn the tools to overcome that stress response and get back into safety, we are giving our kids the most valuable tool we can for the rest of their lives. So that's one piece of it. But then for some kids and for some adults, it truly is harder to establish those safety signals. That's something that, you know, we call the parasympathetic nervous system, engaging our vagus nerve. Many people listening have probably heard of the vagus nerve, the longest nerve in our body that is the counterbalance to the sympathetic fight or flight response. And one of the reasons why we as a society worldwide truly are not able to optimize our vagus nerve safety signal functioning is really and truly due to our diet and lifestyles and our microbiomes not supporting our microbiome vagus nerve brain connection. That vagus nerve is the two-way information highway between your gut and your brain. Now, when we recognize that 80% of the signals actually come from your gut to your brain, and 80% or up to 90% of all of our neurotransmitters like serotonin, which is our rest, relax, manage stress, help us fall asleep, neurotransmitter is actually made by our gut microbiome. So when we're thinking about vagus nerve health and brain health and mental health, we always have to go back to the gut and say, look, what's going on there? And how do we establish a healthy gut microbiome from birth? Or if your child is showing signs of attention and focus issues or anxiety or depression or mood concerns, mm-hmm. Let's look at the gut.
Yeah. In your book, you wrote, Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, said that all disease starts in the gut. But integrative medicine actually kind of turns that around and says all health starts in the gut. You actually call the gut our second brain, or the heart of the immune system.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, for children and for adults, the foundations of our health really do lie in the gut microbiome. The gut microbiome is really comprised. It's an ecosystem that lives inside us. And we actually have microbiomes all over us. Our skin has its own microbiome. Our eyes have their own microbiome. For women, their vaginas have their own microbiome. Even their breast milk glands have their own microbiome. But our gut microbiome is our largest microbiome, our largest ecosystem in us, and the most well-studied to date. I'm sure we're going to have many more studies on the brain's microbiome in the years to come, right? But the microbiome is an ecosystem that houses trillions and trillions of microorganisms that can be friendly or unfriendly bacteria, viruses, parasites, yeast, and all of the genes, the genetic material that they bring with them. And so when we think about this ecosystem and the microbes, hopefully the beneficial microbes that are living in our ecosystem, are designed to cohabitate and live with us and help us stay healthy and happy. So I mentioned that our beneficial microbes, which many know as probiotics, so our probiotic microorganisms in our gut, are responsible for making many of the chemicals that we consider brain chemicals. So there's serotonin I just mentioned, but also dopamine. Our microbiome makes at least 50% of the dopamine in our body, which is responsible for focus, attention, motivation, staying on task. Who doesn't want more of that, right?
Absolutely, right.
For our microbiome also makes 400 times the melatonin than our brain does. Melatonin is our sleep hormone. And the same thing with acetylcholine and GABA and all of these wonderful neurotransmitters, which are gut chemicals. When it comes to our immune system, 70 to 80% of our immune system also is in our gut. And the way our gut microbiome, our probiotics, communicate with the immune cells on our gut lining also informs how are we going to interact with whatever's passing through our gut, whether it's a pathogen like a virus, an abnormal virus or bacteria that's trying to get us sick, or maybe it's a food that we're eating every single day. Are we going to tolerate it, let it pass? Are we going to create a huge inflammatory response? Are we going to continue to create inflammation and have chronic inflammation? Or are we going to maybe attack the wrong thing and start attacking a part of our own body and create an autoimmune response? So how our gut microbes and our microbiome communicates with our immune system really informs how our immune system is going to take shape. And we know that that imbalance can really lead to things like allergic diseases or eczema or autoimmunity. So when we realize that this ecosystem is there to serve us, it puts how we're living and eating and breathing every day in a different light, because we're not just doing that for ourselves. It's not just for instant gratification and pleasure. The way we eat and move and sleep and think really helps to take care of or not our internal microbiome's ecosystem. And most kids nowadays, they learn how to take care of the world's ecosystem. You know, on Earth Day, we reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, we take care of the world's ecosystem, because if we don't, we're going to be at a point where our world's ecosystem will no longer be able to sustain us in a healthy, thriving way. But the same thing is true for our internal ecosystem. If we don't take care of our gut microbiome, our internal ecosystem, we are not going to have an ecosystem that is going to then be able to take care of us, our brains and our bodies and our immune systems.
You also wrote that if your child has a persistent health concern, they may have a leaky gut. What is a leaky gut versus a healthy gut?
Yeah, so that's a really, really important factor to understand with chronic health concerns and persistent health concerns in children and adults. And I love that you picked up the word persistent, because I do, you know, in the book, I really try to distinguish. When we say chronic, it can sound, it sounds much more permanent.
Yeah, it does.
Right? I have this chronic condition. It's never going to go away. It's chronic. I might get better. I might feel better, but I still have this chronic condition. And what I want kids and parents to understand is most conditions that we consider chronic are really, they're persistent. They are, they can be really, you know, a challenge to manage and to recover from, but they don't necessarily have to be a permanent and lifelong factor in your health. For instance, I have kids who, you know, present with metabolic syndrome or type 2 diabetes. Some would say type 2 diabetes, that's a chronic condition. Does it have to be lifelong? Absolutely not. We have the ability to, and the tools, and we can give kids the tools to reverse their type 2 diabetes so that they enter adulthood without it and without having that chronic disease. So then when we think about persistent health concerns or chronic health concerns, we know that that the vast majority of these have as one of their underlying imbalances a leaky gut. And leaky gut is, it's a colloquial term. The medical term is increased intestinal permeability. So that's sort of the medical jargon for leaky gut. Now, a healthy gut lining, when we think about when I'm talking specifically about our small intestinal lining, which is responsible for the absorption of most of our nutrients from our food and also is a barrier to things that shouldn't get into our bloodstream. So our small intestinal lining is comprised of a single cell layer between the inside of our intestines and our bloodstream. Just one microscopic cell layer, which you can imagine could be pretty easy to perturb.
Yeah.
Now, in between each small intestinal cell is a junction. It's literally called a tight junction because it should be tight and it should prevent pathogens or toxins or poisons from getting into your bloodstream or less well-digested pieces of food. And then the small intestinal lining has villi, finger-like projections are lining your entire small intestinal tract. What they are designed to do are to absorb the foods from your intestines. Now, when that junction between the small intestinal cells becomes a little leaky, becomes a little damaged, whether it's from different environmental toxins, whether it's from psychological stress, which can do that, whether it's from antibiotics or infections, both can actually increase the risk of leaky gut, or whether it's from different food additives and ultra-processed foods, which can also increase leaky gut. Well, that junction becomes a little less tight, and guess what? Anything that's not supposed to slip through into your bloodstream starts slipping through, like different, you know, pathogens or different environmental toxins or larger pieces of undigested food that aren't supposed to get in. And then by the same token, those finger-like projections that are supposed to absorb our nutrients become a little bit more frayed and less able to efficiently absorb nutrients. So we get into this state where our kids and us as adults are becoming increasingly less nourished because we're absorbing fewer nutrients from our foods, mm-hmm. and we're becoming increasingly inflamed because all of these inflammatory particles are now allowed to slip through and our immune system says, hey, I can't really handle this anymore, and starts creating an inflammatory response, which then can show up in just about anywhere, whether it's joint pain or whether it's a mental health concern or whether it's skin and eczema or maybe just getting sick frequently.
It's fascinating. Okay, so let's talk about building a healthy gut. In your book, you talk about the five things that are the foundation for building a healthy gut and for getting optimal health and resilience.
Yeah, I love it. And the five things, I call them the five things for microbiome magic, because we have to, as a parent and a pediatrician, I know if it's not doable and also if it's not fun, it's not going to last.
Yeah.
And this is really for a lifetime. I mean, this is something that I want all families to get on board with, because if we learn how to do these five things that we actually are already doing every single day, but we learn how to do them in a way that creates microbiome magic, if we learn how to be gut heroes every day, then we have a whole path of health and wellness in front of us. Like I said, these are things that we're already doing. It's just that we want to make these small shifts in how we're doing them. So these five things are how we nourish our microbiome. What are we eating every day? How are we breathing? Mm. And by breathing, I mean, how are we engaging our vagus nerve, practicing mindfulness every day? How are we moving our bodies? How are we hydrating? And how are we sleeping? These are five things that if we learn how to really create microbiome magic with these five things, then we will, like I said, be able to reverse a lot of the health concerns that your child or you may be having, and also set them forward on a really truly preventive path, on a path to thriving.
That's great. Okay, so let's start with nourish. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about the importance of what we're feeding our kids. Your book recommends that we swap fake foods with real foods. Talk about that, and also the importance of reading labels.
Yeah. So nourish, I split up into two categories. Nourish part one, what do you want to get in? And nourish part two, what do you want to keep out? And I put these five things for microbiome magic in a wheel of whole gut resilience. And a wheel is a really important concept because a wheel does not have a start or an end. So mm-hmm. it doesn't matter where you start. If you have a child who is the pickiest of eaters right now and trying to think about how to get in, you know, one more vegetable on their plate is really stressful, then don't start there. Start with one of the other five things. But with nourish, I want to give parents some options. When we're thinking about what to get in, these are our microbiome champions. And I call them the three Fs. So fiber, phytonutrients, which is a pH, but it sounds like an F, and fermented foods. So if we think about how we might be able to get each of these three things or one of these three things into our diet, and I have lots of really, really practical and fun tips. One of the tips for doing this is asking kids to think about how they can make every meal pop, P-O-P. So plants on purpose. because the foods that nourish our microbiome, they are plant-based. Fiber and phytonutrients are found in colorful fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and nuts and seeds. They're all plants. And so when we think about how do we make each meal or snack pop with just one more plant on purpose, it makes it doable. It gets your creative juices flowing. So some examples might be, you know, if you're making oatmeal and you're putting, you know, with blueberries and you're putting in, maybe you're already putting on some flax seeds into your oatmeal. Well, okay, that's awesome. That's three plants right there. But let's maybe think about how to make it pop even more. Maybe throw in a handful of pumpkin seeds on there. Maybe throw in some, you know, dried cranberries. You know, think about how, and kids love it. I had this one four-year-old, a mom wrote me and said, you know, after she heard me speaking about making meals pop, she immediately came over to her mom who was making dinner and asked her, hey, are we going to make this pop? And then, and then asked her dad the very next morning, she remembered, and his dad was making breakfast, she asked, how are we going to make breakfast pop? And so it's just a fun way to remember.
That's awesome.
Right. And then nourish part two is what can we keep out? Now, most people worldwide are eating some foods out of a package. And even for me as a holistic pediatrician, I'm going to say I love going and finding, you know, easy packaged foods that are also healthy and nutritious and are going to serve my child's microbiome and their brains and their immune systems. But we have to learn how to be very, very savvy food label detectives. Kids can learn how to do that. I truly believe that two of the most important life skills to teach our children and our teenagers is how to regulate their nervous system, as we spoke about before, and how to read food labels like a gut hero. Those two things, and I will be so happy sending kids off to college knowing, okay, they have those foundations.
Does it matter if fruits and vegetables are organic or not?
That's a great question. In the ideal world, we would eat all organic foods. The reason being is because the herbicides and the pesticides used that are sprayed on non-organic foods, and let's take glyphosate or Roundup, which is the most common one that's used nowadays. Glyphosate was actually originally patented by Monsanto as an antibiotic. So when we eat a food that's been heavily sprayed with glyphosate, we are inadvertently consuming a product that actually has been shown to preferentially kill some of our beneficial probiotic bacteria and preserve some of our more harmful bacteria like Clostridia. So that would be ideal, but I know that's not realistic for many families, either due to access issues or cost issues, which are a very real concern. And, you know, and even foods that are labeled organic can have pesticide residues on them. So my suggestion would be, now this holds mostly for the states where the Environmental Working Group has a list called the Dirty Dozen, which is a list of the most heavily sprayed pesticide-laden produce. Every year there's a new list, but guaranteed you will see strawberries and kale on that list year after year. Okay, so strawberries and kale, I really do my best to eat organically as often as possible. And then there's a list called the Clean 15, which are our least sprayed foods. And here's the thing, you know, there are ways that we can minimize, even from non-organic foods, the pesticides that we ingest, not with the fancy pesticide, cleaners, but simply just even running our fruits and vegetables under water for a couple of minutes. You can use a vinegar wash. I give some examples in the book. So this is not to say if you can't find organic, don't eat the fruits and vegetables. Yeah. It's to say do the best you can, and then please still eat your fruits and vegetables.
Can you give an idea of some of those things that are harmful to a child's gut microbiome? Sugar makes stress worse. Is that right?
Yeah. So in part two of what do we keep out and learning how to read food labels like a gut hero, there's, you know, keeping out the glyphosate, you know, the herbicides, keeping out the food additives. But added sugar is also one of the top three microbiome mischief makers that I talk about.
How about gluten and dairy?
Gluten and dairy have a special place, I would say. gluten and dairy, the proteins from gluten and dairy, so gluten and casein is the protein from dairy, have actually been found to trigger leaky gut, even in folks who are not allergic or sensitive to gluten and dairy. So when you are in a place where you're working on healing your gut, then those are foods that I would strongly encourage eliminating during that healing process and then seeing how much you can tolerate. Now, some of that, when we're eliminating gluten though, we also still wanna make sure that we are very savvy about reading the food labels, because a lot of gluten-free food is not healthy for you. You know, a lot of gluten-free food is actually, right, when you look at the labels, laden with sugar. To wrap up the added sugar conversation, I do believe that the increased consumption of added sugar in our youth and adults is one of the major culprits for chronic and persistent health concerns. You know, 100 years ago, yes, we were eating added sugars, but it was somewhere in the order of maybe 2 teaspoons per day. 2 teaspoons. The average teenager nowadays has about 34 teaspoons of added sugar in a day.
Wow.
And the average adult is probably around 19 plus teaspoons of added sugar in a day. And that wreaks havoc on our brains and our immune systems and our gut microbiome. And so, and really the way that those added sugars sneak in, for the most part, for many of our youth and adults, are those sugary drinks. I mean, Starbucks, yeah, Frappuccinos, boba teas,
right,
you know, and when we think about the sugar-free ones, those are not any better, because the artificial sweeteners have also been found to disrupt the gut microbiome on many levels. And some have even been found to be more addictive than cocaine. I mean, we've all seen, you know, many of us have heard of, oh, sugar lights up the same reward centers in our brain as cocaine. Well, they took this one study of rats who were already addicted to cocaine, and those rats actually preferred saccharin over cocaine. So we're not actually helping reduce our sugar addictions by going to the artificial stuff. We just want to overall lower the food industry's hold on what our palates think is sweet enough, and realize sweet enough means the sweetness from fruits and not the tons of added sugar that's found in so many of our packaged foods.
There is so much more in your book. The book is Healthy Kids, Happy Kids. I want to just, because of time, move on to the next one, Breathe. Let's talk about some of the important things of kids learning to take time and slow down. You mentioned mindfulness practices.
Yeah. And this is where understanding the microbiome vagus nerve brain connection is so key, because everything that we do, all of these 5 things that really create that microbiome magic, is going to help your child's future mental health and immune health. And it has that ripple effect on virtually every single organ system in our body. And same thing with mindfulness. When we put mindfulness in that category of this two-way street, when I practice mindfulness, it's going to help support my child's gut microbiome. And when I support my child's gut microbiome, it's going to help them regulate their nervous system and also be better able to practice that mindfulness. It becomes a secondary, oh, I'll do it when I have time, or oh, that's just for, you know, if I have stress. Well, here's the thing. The reason why I named the chapter Breathe and have an entire chapter on this is because this is something that we really need to be thinking about doing every single day, not just when we're stressed, because there's no way we're going to be able to engage our vagus nerve when we're stressed if we haven't learned how to use it before. When we exercise and engage our vagus nerve, feeling good and calm and relaxed, that is an awesome side effect. But the real benefit of engaging our vagus nerve is because it reduces chronic inflammation. It balances hormones. It regulates your blood sugar. It helps your brain cope with stress. We have all of these. And oh, by the way, it helps, you know, prevent us from getting sick and supports our gut microbiome. So all of these other effects that are really kind of the foundations of health and wellness. And great, you get to feel good at the same time. And so, you know, when we think about breathe. There are a couple of different mindfulness exercises that I that are easy that I did with my own kids even when they were little that we can do. But I call it breathe because the way we breathe every moment of the day can engage your vagus nerve. When we engage our vagus nerve and breathe with our diaphragm, when we belly breathe, keep our shoulders down, and as we take a deep breath in, we're imagining a balloon in our belly expanding while our chest and our shoulders stay still. And then we hold the breath just a little bit. And as we exhale slowly, the balloon in our belly deflates again as we hold our chest and our shoulders still. And just by slowing our breath down, that immediately engages your vagus nerve. The stress response, when we're in that fight or flight, we start breathing faster. That's a normal stress response. Our heart starts to beat faster. We breathe faster so that we can get ready to fight or run. Now, when we purposefully slow down our breath, that is actually one of the few ways that we can purposefully engage our vagus nerve and slow down that sympathetic, that stress response. You cannot purposefully slow down your heart rate. I mean, try as you might, right? You can slow down your breathing, which in turn, when you slow down your breathing, it will slow down your heart rate and it will lower that stress response.
Oh, that's great. Okay, hydrate. What is the easy way to remember how much water you should be drinking every day?
Yes, I love that because we need it easy, right? We need easy and doable. So, and this is also true for adults. 8 in 10 adults don't drink enough water. And then to expect our kids to be able to stay hydrated. Well, what is hydrated enough though? So on any given day at baseline, it's not super hot. You're not, you know, running around in 90 degree weather, sweating up a storm. You're also not sick and, you know, losing body fluids from whatever source. On a normal day, what you want to do is take your weight in pounds and divide that in half, and that is the approximate number of ounces of fluid, water, that you should drink every day at a baseline. Now, add more if you are, you know, exercising a lot or sweating a lot or losing body fluids because maybe you're vomiting or having diarrhea, right?
That's great. Okay, next one is move. Regular exercise has so many benefits. Talk real briefly about that.
Yeah. So regular exercise actually has a two-way street with your gut microbiome. Regular exercise actually can improve your gut microbiome diversity, and it can do that independent of diet. So even if your kids are not the most varied eaters just yet, not getting a lot of plants in their food, if they love to move and they move their bodies and they exercise every day, maybe minimum 20 minutes a day, that will improve their gut microbiome, which is awesome. On the flip side, you know, not moving and sedentary, you know, lifestyles can also change your gut microbiome for the worse. So we want to keep moving and make it fun. You know, it can be, I would love it to be a family affair. We've started now with our families going on a really brisk neighborhood walk. It's short. We all have homework to do, work to do, et cetera, but it's like a 20 to 25 minute walk, depending on how fast we're walking. And we do that every day, you know, before dinner, and then we come home. So that's exercise. And then the last one is sleep, and sleep too. You know, sleep is amazing. You know, the connection between your gut microbiome, our microbiome, our probiotics in our gut have their own circadian rhythm. And some of those probiotics have the opposite circadian rhythm. They are more active and doing more good for us while we are asleep. So if we are not paying attention to our circadian rhythm and optimizing our sleep, we're not giving our gut microbiome the opportunity it needs to be active while we're sleeping and make us all the nutrients that we need and all the health benefits.
Is it too late? If we start to follow the advice in your book, can it make a difference in an adult's life as well?
Absolutely. And I've had, you know, parents and grandparents write to me and say, you know, this is not just a kid's book. This is a book for everyone, whether or not you have kids. And it's for the whole family, for multiple generations. It is never too late to optimize your gut microbiome. Now, the older we are, the tougher it can get. So I would love everyone to start as young as possible. But this is not just a one and done. This is a way of life.
Yeah.
And this is something that we want to teach our kids, but we can embrace at any age, knowing that, you know, even if we have a laundry list of, you know, particular diagnoses, just by really learning how to every day create that microbiome magic, you will move towards a healthier, more thriving life, no matter how old you are. The other thing that I just want to leave parents and listeners with as we close our interview is just to know that there is hope. I mean, I'm all about, you know, spreading the knowledge, which sometimes can be a little frightening. But then with eyes wide open, we move forward with hope because there's so much that we can do.
Yeah. Dr. Elisa Song, it is such a pleasure talking with you. I hope we can do this again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, Dr. Elisa Song's book is Healthy Kids, Happy Kids, and her website is healthykidshappykids.com. If you have kids, Dr. Elisa Song's book is filled with so much great information, including an exclusive website that has even more health tips and articles written for what Dr. Song calls gut heroes. So you may want to check that out. If you're an HPE team member, also remember the many resources available to you and your family members in the HPE Global Wellness Program. If you're in the U.S., you'll find those on myhperewards.com. And if you're outside the U.S., you'll find them on the Global Wellness page. Thanks to my guest today, Dr. Elisa Song, for sharing so much great information. And as always, just know that we do this podcast just for you. So thank you for listening. We hope the information has been useful. And if so, please tell your friends and your coworkers. That's it for this one. Until next time, please take good care of yourself and your kids. Let's talk again soon.